Been in a little series that I started on servant and slave. What does it mean when Jesus calls us to be a servant and slave? We started a couple weeks ago in Matthew 20. We really focused in on the two words that Jesus uses there, deaconos, which means servant, and doulos, which means slave, and focusing on the fact that it was a slavery of choice. Like, this is not the kind of slavery where you're forced into it, but this is the kind of slavery where we choose to go down that path. And then last week we looked at Luke 17 and the wonderful parable that Jesus tells about this slave who's been out working in the fields, and he comes in out of the field, and Jesus is like, well, would he come out of the field and expect to get a break? No, the master would insist that he clean himself up and prepare the meal for himself and serve the master, and then only after he served the master would he get a break. And so we looked at that last week. This week I want to look at Mark 9. And kind of a long narrative passage. This is a really unique story because Jesus ends it by saying, you're going to be my servant. To follow me, you have to be a servant. But there's all kinds of context. There's all kinds of stuff leading up to this passage that really makes it important. And we got to get through this and take a look at it. All right, so in your Bibles, Mark 9. I'll just start reading at verse 2, Mark 9, verse 2. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter and James and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. He did not know what to say. They were so frightened. Then a cloud appeared and enveloped them, and a voice came from the cloud. This is my son whom I love. Listen to him. Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. They kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant. And they asked him, why do teachers of the law say Elijah must come first? Now, we're going to stop there. We're going to look through this, and then we're going to keep reading through much of the chapter 9. So Jesus takes his inner circle, so to speak, Peter, James, and John, and he goes up on this mountain. Now, for looking, again, we're setting all of this context to look at his end command at the end of this passage we're looking at where he says you have to be a servant, where, again, he calls us to be a servant. So why is this important? Well, he takes the three up on the mountain. And so that certainly gives them the opportunity for pride, doesn't it? We were the three that got to go up with Jesus on the mountain. Want to see my resume? But now you think about the other nine that were left behind. It certainly gives them the opportunity for jealousy. It also gives them the opportunity for striving. Oh, we'll show those three. Look what we're going to do. Well, while they're up there playing around with Jesus, we're down here doing the real work. And so there's opportunity for pride and there's opportunity for jealousy as we lead into this story where Jesus tells them to be servants. I love how in verses 5 and 6, Peter gets a little confused by the whole thing and he offers to build them some tents. He's completely missing the point because he's trying to take a physical action for something that's entirely spiritual. Again, why is that important? Well, because he's a little confused. And I'm wanting you to see, I'm setting the stage for what Jesus is going to say. So Peter is a little confused at this point. He's not quite sure what's going on. These appearances of Moses and Elijah happen. And again, it's spiritual. And he's offering to build a physical tent. Then verse 7, God speaks to them from a cloud. It already said that they didn't know what to say. They were so frightened. And so now God speaks from the cloud. And I just imagine that they probably needed clean shorts at this point. You know, they were already scared, and all of a sudden a big voice comes from the cloud, and they're probably just running around in circles going, oh my gosh, what do we do? And then just like that, it's over. Verse 8, it just says they're gone, and it's over. So they have this incredible mountaintop experience, but then Jesus says, hey, guys, you can't tell anybody anything about this. You got to keep it to yourself. Now, what's the first thing that happens when you tell somebody to keep it to themselves? It burns inside of them until they tell somebody, right? So now they've got this good news in them, and it's burning inside of them, and they're like, oh my gosh, we've had this incredible moment. Well, verse 10, it says they kept it to themselves, at least for the time being, but they're asking each other, well, what does rising from the dead mean? Like, we're still a little confused. What is this all about? So we just continue to see this confusion and lack of understanding from the kingdom. And so this whole scene, even though Peter, James, and John had this incredible mountaintop experience where they're with Jesus and they hear the voice of the Lord and they see Elijah and Moses, they come down from the mountain with their head spinning. What does all of this mean? So now we'll skip ahead to verse 14 and we'll continue to read. When they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and the teachers of the law arguing with them. As soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. What are you arguing about with them? He asked. A man in the crowd answered, Teacher, I brought you my son who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not. Oh, unbelieving generation, Jesus replied. How long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? I love the way Jesus minces words, don't you? Bring the boy to me. So they brought him. When the evil spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground and rolled around foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the boy's father, how long has he been like this? From childhood, he answered. It has often thrown him into the fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. If you can, said Jesus, everything is possible for him who believes. Immediately the boy's father explained, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. When Jesus saw that a crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the evil spirit. You deaf and mute spirit, he said, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. The spirit shrieked, convulsed him violently, and came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said, he's dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him to his feet, and he stood up. After Jesus had gone indoors, his disciples asked him privately, why couldn't we drive it out? He replied, this kind can come out only by prayer. And then some manuscripts add fasting. So Jesus and his inner circle, they come down from the mountain, and they find the other nine disciples arguing with some of the teachers of the law. Jesus immediately can tell something's not right, right? And so he immediately goes over, he's like, hey guys, what's going on? What you arguing about? I love that about Jesus. He immediately sees the problem, and he just comes in and, hey, what's going on? And so the story is that a man has brought this child, his son, who's possessed with a demon, and he's brought him to the disciples. He's got expectations. He had faith. He had hope that the disciples could somehow minister to his son. Can you imagine the anguish that the father had watching his son be tormented by this demon? And when the demon would throw him into the fire or throw him into the water. And so the father musters up the courage and the faith to bring this boy to these nine disciples, knowing that these guys had been with Jesus. But then imagine his disappointment when those nine disciples couldn't do anything. And the demon probably just mocked him. There's a whole lot going on in this passage, and I love to teach on this passage on deliverance, but that's not today's message. Today's message is Jesus called to be a servant. But this passage is very important to that. So just kind of jumping back into that. So Jesus comes up. He sees the situation. He asks. And the father says, I have this son, and your disciples couldn't do it. And Jesus just says, well, bring the boy here. Jesus just gives one command, come out, and the demon leaves. No arguing, no big scene, no commotion. And then, of course, the disciples are still confused. So they ask Jesus about it, and Jesus gives them a very simple answer. This kind can only come out by prayer. That's a whole message in itself right there, that verse. But again, today we're just focusing on his command to be a servant. So continuing, moving on, chapter 9, verse 30. They left that place and passed through Galilee. Jesus did not want anyone to know where they were, because he was teaching his disciples. He said to them, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise. But they did not understand what he meant and were afraid to ask him about it. So Jesus gets alone with his disciples after this whole scene with the boy and the demon. They go off and says they went off alone because he was teaching them. So he gets off and he's mentoring, he's discipling them, he's teaching them. But they don't get it. They still don't understand what he's saying, and they're too afraid to ask. This is really important. Jesus has spent time with them, and he's pouring into them, but yet they're afraid to ask. Continuing, verse 33, they came to Capernaum. When he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the road?" But they kept quiet because they had argued about who was the greatest. So they go back to this home, wherever it is that they're staying. Some suggest maybe it was Peter's house. But again, Jesus immediately knows something isn't right. And so they come into the house, and he's like, "So guys, as we were walking along, what were you guys arguing about?" Don't you love that? They've been arguing the whole way. Jesus let them argue. He let them argue. And then they get to the house, and he's like, "So, guys, what was all that about? Were they arguing over theology? No. Were they arguing over best practices of ministry? No. They were arguing over who was the greatest." Now, let's think about this for a minute. The three that had been on the mountain were frightened and confused. The nine that had stayed behind couldn't drive out a demon. Jesus gets alone with them. He tells them about his coming death and resurrection, and they're so confused they don't even bother to ask him. And now they're going to argue about who's the greatest? Are you kidding me? Do you see how all of this sets up this place in the story? All of this in Mark 9, up to this point, shows that the disciples were really pretty inept and confused. And now here they're arguing about who's the greatest. Really. But do you see how this affects ministry? The nine couldn't drive out the demon because this attitude of who was the greatest was already in them. The other three can't comprehend what Jesus is talking about as he explains the kingdom because they have this attitude of who's the greatest in them. And so this whole attitude becomes this huge barrier between them and being able to do effective ministry. Do you think that still exists today? I have people ask me all the time, "How come I don't see people get healed when I pray for them?" Now, there can be a lot of different answers to that question. But frequently I ask them, "Have you cleaned any toilets lately?" If you want to operate in ministry, if you want to be able to do these kinds of things, like setting this boy free from the demon, it starts with a servant's heart. I know of one vineyard church in particular. It's a very large vineyard church. And if you want to serve in any capacity, even if they're considering you as paid staff, you have to clean the bathrooms for 6 months first. You can have no position and no title, and they will not hire you as paid staff until you've cleaned the bathrooms for 6 months. And they watch your attitude, and they watch how you do it. And seriously, people come up to me all the time, and, "Oh, I want to move in signs and wonders, and I want to move in power ministry, and I've prayed for people, and I've never seen anything." When's the last time you cleaned your church's bathrooms? I mean, it starts there. That's what Jesus is talking about. And the disciples here, they're completely missing the point of the kingdom. Then, throughout this whole section, we see that the disciples are arguing. The nine argued with the religious leaders, then they were arguing with each other along the road. So first they have who's the greatest, but now they also have an argumentative spirit. Because all they wanted was greatness in the eyes of the world. They were arguing to try to elevate themselves. Right? That's what they were arguing about, is to try to look good in front of the eyes of the religious leaders or try to look good amongst their peers, the other disciples. Does this still happen in the church today? I talked to somebody this week who is completely done with church because of the politics in church. That broke my heart. I will slap you if you get political in my church. This isn't what the church is about. It's not about position and power and titles and who does what. If you come to me and you ask, "Hey, can I serve?" I'll be like, "Yeah, the toilets need cleaning." And I love it when people come and tell me what they did. Oh, Pastor, I noticed the bathroom was out of toilet paper, so I put some in there for you. Thanks. Awesome. Jesus is always looking forward to the cross. His disciples are still looking for greatness in the eyes of the world. We cannot follow in the footsteps of the disciples in this regard. This really will get in the way of doing ministry. And here's why. You want to operate in signs and wonders. Jesus commanded us to what? Heal the sick, cleanse the leper, cast out demons, raise the dead. Here, they can't deliver this boy of a demon. These are the kinds of things that we're called to, but we will not see them effectively until we have a servant's heart. Why? Because God will not share his glory. If you're arguing about who is the greatest, if you have the spirit and attitude of I'm great, he will not allow signs and wonders to happen through you because you will steal his glory. And we see that happen all the time. You'll see somebody start out well, and then their ministry grows, and they see bigger and bigger things, and then they crash and burn because at some point in time, it wasn't based on a servant's heart. It was based on a hey, look at me heart, and eventually that all implodes on them, and the ministry falls apart. Just this year, there was a massive megachurch in Seattle, Washington, that crashed and burned and closed. A church with over 10,000 members because it was all based on the personality of the senior pastor who did not have a servant's heart. Now, continuing along, Mark 9, verse 35. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, if anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and servant of all. Jesus gives the same message we've seen him give so many times before. This time in the Greek, it's the word deaconos, from where we get our English word deacon. The primary meaning behind this is one who serves others. A far cry from the way the disciples have been acting, arguing with each other, arguing with the leaders, unable to do basic ministry, thinking only of themselves. But what's interesting here is Jesus doesn't just say servant of some, he says servant of all. That's really important because there can be this other attitude in serving of I serve who very selectively. I'm going to serve this person because I'll look good. I'm going to serve this person because then maybe I'll get promoted. I'll serve this person because I want to be associated with them. But Jesus says, no, servant of all. Servant of all. You don't get to pick and choose who you serve. Because when we pick and choose, that's the politics of church, right? And that's the thing that the outside world is really sick of seeing in the church. But then he says something else here. Jesus also says, you must be the very last. This is the Greek word eschatos, from where we get our English word eschaton. Y'all use the word eschaton every day, don't you? That's in your regular vocabulary, isn't it? That's a good coffee table word. Just throw that out there in your next conversation, eschaton. But here it's the Greek word eschatos. Listen to these definitions. Last, final, lowest, most insignificant, last in time or place, last in rank, grade, or worth. Jesus says you must be servant of all, but you must be the last and the very least as you do it. And when you put these two together, it has an emphatic force in the Greek language. He's not just saying be a servant. He's escalating it to an even higher level when he says be the last. Be the least. So where is there any room in that for arguing about who is the greatest? And I long to see this commandment lived out in the church in general. Man, I just see so many churches, and churches are so personality-driven and programmatically driven. Where are the deaconesses? Where are the eschatoses? Someone who's willing to be last, to be the least, to be the most insignificant. Again, I think of Mother Teresa. What a perfect example of that. She shunned the attention and just served the most needy of the world. It's an attitude that Jesus told us to have, and it's an attitude that the church needs, and it's an attitude that the rest of the world is actually hungry for. To see people just serving from a plain and pure heart of eschatos. Then continuing, Jesus uses an illustration with a little child, verse 36. He took a little child and had him stand among them. Taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but the one who sent me." So why would Jesus bring in a child and use the child as the example? I couldn't state it any better than this quote. So let me read this quote to you from a commentary. It says this: "To squelch the disciples' hankering for worldly greatness, Jesus uses a child as an illustration of kingdom greatness. No romanticized notion of children existed in the first century. Children had no power, status, or rights. They were not considered full persons and were regarded as somewhat akin to property. They were dependent, vulnerable, unlearned, and entirely subject to the authority of the father. The rabbis classified children with the deaf, the dumb, the weak-minded, and slaves. Nowhere else in this time period do we find children used as an example to be imitated. To become a child basically means to recognize one's insignificance. What evokes repentance is the realization that one is as small and slight as a child before God. Children in this time period had no standing. It said that they were considered with the blind and the dumb and the deaf, the weak-minded and the slaves, and they had no rights. And so Jesus, knowing that culture, understanding that culture, he brings this child and he holds him and says, "You've got to be like one of these." That would have been shocking to the religious leaders who were lurking around the corners, around the edges. Even his own disciples would have been like, "What? Where's my throne? Where's my crown?" Children had no place in society. He says, "But no, you have to be like this." So he adds another level. He calls us to be a deaconos, which is a servant. He calls us to be an eschatos, which is the last and the least. And then he says to be a child, which means to have no place, to have no significance. And it's from that place that he will give us greatness. When we intentionally put ourselves into these positions, deaconos, eschatos, child, then he gets to lift us up. He gets to take us to a place where he can do things through us because he knows that we will not steal our glory, his glory. And then I want to look at one final little illustration here, starting in verse 38. "Teacher," said John, "we saw a man driving out demons in your name, and we told him to stop because he was not one of us." There's that attitude again. Look at how great we are. You're not a part of us. You can't do this. It's that attitude of greatness. "Do not stop them," Jesus said. "No one who does a miracle in my name can in the next moment say anything bad about me. For whoever is not against us is for us. I tell you the truth, anyone who gives a cup of water in my name because you belong to Christ will certainly not lose his reward." What's Jesus saying here? The pay is the same. Whether you drive a demon out of a child or whether you simply give somebody a cup of water, the pay is the same. There's no greatness in the kingdom. You always see people looking for titles, looking for positions, looking for certain things. Oh, I want to have this gift, or I want to do that ministry. I want to do what he does. My ministry seems too low. My ministry seems too insignificant. I want this. Jesus says, no, if you give a cup of water, it's the same. It's the same. You give a cup of water, it's the same as if you healed somebody or delivered them of a demon. And so as we serve and we do something simple, like clean a toilet, or go get something for somebody that they need, it's the same. In the kingdom, it's the same. And God sees it the same. See, God doesn't see us in different levels. Oh, wow, look at what she did. That was amazing. Johnny over here, wow, man, just a cup of water, really, really, bro? That's the best you could do? God doesn't see it that way. It's all the same in his eyes. Look, Johnny brought that man a cup of water. Oh, bless Johnny. That is so awesome. Why can't we be as excited about the simple things as we are about the big things? Because in God's eyes, it's the same. And the other thing about this kind of serving that Jesus calls us to, a deaconos, a doulos, an eschatos, is not a momentary place of position. It's always. These are all ongoing. You'll see the flash and burns. Somebody shows up once, does a little cleaning, looks for some fanfare, and you don't see that person on the cleaning crew again for 7 years. The deaconesses, the doulosses, the eschatosses, they do it week in and week out. Week in and week out. Week in and week out. Because they're not looking to get noticed. I'm going to make a really bold statement. If you get burned out in ministry, in any level, if whether you're the senior pastor or the person that sweeps the sidewalks, if you get burned out, it's because you were doing it for yourself. It did not come from a place of deaconess and doulos. When we do it in the right place, burnout's not an option. Right? We see so many people burn out in ministry. They weren't following these simple guidelines. If you're burned out, it's because what you're in a sense saying is, hey, I didn't get enough attention. I don't need attention when I serve. I'm serving because I love Jesus. And Jesus loves me. And so I can get up in the morning, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, decade after decade, and just do the same thing. Because I love Jesus. And Jesus loves me. I love our new national director, Phil Strout. Anyone ever comes to him and says, hey, what's the new thing? What's the new thing? And Phil will be like, well, go out, evangelize, make disciples, baptize them, and then just do it again. And then do that year after year, decade after decade. Phil always says, he goes, I'm looking for people that can serve for 30, 40, 50 years doing the same thing simply because they love Jesus. They're not looking for attention. They don't burn out. Their heart's in the right place. Ministry isn't a little thing. Ministry is the rest of your life, whatever that is. We're deaconesses, doulosses, eschatosses, and children of the Lord the rest of our life. So wrapping it up for today. Failing to come to grips with Jesus' call to be servants and last of all can have serious negative consequences for ministry. The disciples couldn't drive out a demon. Imagine the disappointment of that father. I came here to get help, and they couldn't do it. We always have to make sure that we are coming from the right place because we never know. You never know when someone's going to show up on your doorstep and say, man, my kid needs help. Can you pray for him? So you always have to be in that place where you know that your heart is in the right position. Looking for greatness in the eyes of the world can have the same effect. You cannot steal God's glory, so don't try. So I want to do something a little bit different today. As we head into ministry time, I just have two questions for you to consider. Have you been feeling the tug of the Lord to be a doulos or a deaconos in a certain area? Has he been calling you to serve at a new level, but you've been resisting, thinking that's too much, or I'm not sure? And then the second question is, ask the Lord to show you if there's any way where you have been serving and your heart hasn't been in it for the right reasons. You've served for attention, or you've served for whatever. So just as we sing our last song and head into ministry time, just keep those two questions in the back of your mind. Let's stand and sing our last song.